So welcome everyone again, part two of our recording for our JCC Coffee, Cake, and Learning. And we are today going to be discussing the tragedy of loss of 24,000 students at Rebbe Akiva. And the question is, missing the forest for the trees, how come we still memorialize and mourn for the 24,000 students who died, and we'll discuss how they died and what the story was there, when so many other calamitous events are not memorialized in a unique day or a period of time? We have a custom for 33 days from Passover until Lag BaOmer. Many have a custom not to shave and not to get haircuts, not to listen to live music, etc. In other words, actual mourning practices are observed. So it's kind of unique. It's not a one-day mourning period. It's kind of like a 33-day mourning period. So it's very strange. Why should this be? So today, the idea of missing the forest for the trees. Let me just contextualize the question. I'll use medical analogies. Unfortunately, I'm very good at those today. Here's a medical analogy. You have your GP, your primary care physician, your general practice doctor. Wonderful doctor, he or she. They love you. They're great. But then when you need a certain type of expertise, and the GP or the PCP feels, and I'm in the presence of doctors, so you please correct me, but if they feel, oh my gosh, you need a specialist because this is just a little bit out of my purview. They went to medical school for an extra year or two, and this is their bailiwick. I like that old word. This is the way they see the world through the prism of, you know, spinal areas. You know, so go to an orthopedic surgeon, whatever it is. Go to Dr. Pernikov when it's things below your stomach, because he's the best in the valley as a surgeon for that area. You got to go to a specialist, not a general practitioner. So the question is, in Judaism, is it better to have a rabbi who's sort of a general practitioner, who knows a little bit, sometimes a lot, but about a lot of areas of Judaism? Or is it better to specialize in one area of Jewish law? So you could have a bunch of rabbis. They may know a little bit about everything, but they specialize in certain things. So when they're very complex rules that come about, and we actually have such rabbis. There are rabbis who are noted, for example, if I have an issue, let's say, with the laws of Jewish divorce. So there are a few rabbis that I would call and seek out their expertise. Or the ritual bath that we call a mikvah. There are a few rabbis who are noted for being experts in everything, because the mikvah is a very difficult, convoluted thing, and how much water, rainwater, natural water, and how you build, you know, the pit. So it's very specialized, and you would need a rabbi who has an expertise in that specialty. Now you might say, but aren't there rabbis who kind of are specialists in everything? Yeah, there've been a couple over the millennia, but not too many. Usually we have specialties and there's subspecialties. So today we're going to try to discuss, how is that relevant to Rabbi Akiva and his students? And we're going to find out in the end that it is extremely, tragically relevant to what went wrong. So let's start with source one. Source one in our sheet of missing the forest for the trees comes courtesy of the Talmud, the Babylonian Talmud. So after the destruction of Beit HaMikdash number one, of the Holy Temple number one, approximately, it's a debate. What isn't a debate in Judaism, right? But it's a debate that it took place in the year 586 before the Common Era. So we're going back about 2,700 or so years, a long time ago. King Nebuchadnezzar, or as they used to call him in English, Nebuchadnezzar. By the way, Nebuchadnezzar was the reason the kings didn't sign their names and got a signet ring. You know, for all official documents, they could just... If your name was like King Achashverosh or King Nebuchadnezzar, good luck, right, signing those 5,000 documents a day as the monarch. So King Nebuchadnezzar sent his army, and they destroyed Jerusalem and the holy city of Jerusalem, the Beit HaMikdash, and they took most but not all of the Jewish people captive or hostage, those who survived the fighting, and they took them to Babylonia, modern-day Iraq, Iran, that area of the world. And the Jewish people prospered there. Now, we know the rest of the story because we have a holiday called Purim. And we know that after 70 years, the Jewish people did come back. But there remained in Babylonia a significant Jewish community. So much so that later on, hundreds of years later, when the Romans in the year 70 of the Common Era destroyed the second temple, the Beit HaMikdash, you then had a significant portion of the Jewish people, the rabbis, etc., living in Babylonia. And they created the oral tradition that they wrote down. We call it the Talmud Bavli, the Babylonian Talmud. to differentiate it from an earlier Talmud that was called the Jerusalem Talmud, written in Israel. Now, the Babylonian Talmud is the go-to source for Talmud. So when you hear someone say, oh, this is a Talmudic quote, 99.9% of the time, it's going to come from the Babylonian Talmud. 2,700 double sides folios. It's quite awe-inspiring. And then on each and every word of those 2,700 plus pages, double-sided, you have copious amounts, as the generations have played out, of commentaries and sub-commentaries and super-commentaries. Till this day, there's still commentaries literally being published every year. So we have at our fingertips an amazing thing. I remember a few years ago I had a program called the Bar Ilan program. It was like this copious set of CDs. It was so big you couldn't really like download it, so you had to buy it as old-fashioned CDs. Today, with today's fast gigabit connections, I'm sure we could download it. You know, but good luck. Good luck 10 years ago downloading it with, you know, a 52K modem. You know, that would be fun, right? 12 days later, you know, someone calls you. No! Did you ever experience that? You're downloading something big and all of a sudden someone interrupts your download with a phone call and you say, sorry, connection lost, start again. Okay. That would drive a person to drink, right? And more than coffee. So this Bar Ilan program was amazing because you could click on, I'm not exaggerating, any word of the Torah, the written Torah, the Tanakh, 24 books of the Torah, Bible, prophets, holy writings. And it would give you a subsection of everything written on that. So you would go through layers of oral tradition, of the Talmud, of early commentaries called Rishonim, and the later commentaries called Acharonim. And it was amazing. So what we have at our fingertips today is literally awe-inspiring. Now, clearly, you learn to prioritize. You know, which commentaries are given more credibility and what are, you know, the go-to. So, for example, if I'm just giving you a little sidebar here, I hope you don't mind, because it helps to flesh out the greatness of Rabbi Akiva. So, all these things that I'm referring to, none existed written-wise in the time that we're just going to discuss today, Rabbi Akiva and the Roman Empire at its ascension. We didn't have a printing press. Shockingly, there was no art scroll publisher. Ooh, we don't know how that happened, but it happened. We had a world without publications. And so everything that we're describing was basically an oral mandate, an oral tradition. So you can imagine the dedication of the rabbis and the rebbetzins to memorize copious amounts. They probably played little memory games. Remember the mega memory from years ago, one of those commercials that guy was trying to hawk? There was a book, you know, how to increase your memory. Right. I don't know if it worked or not, but I'm sure they played a lot of memory games. And maybe different rabbis who had photographic memories were given a task. Hey, we don't care if you comment on it. Remember it. So from generation to generation, it was transmitted orally, and all this existed. So in the time of Rabbi Akiva, there was nothing written down. Today, we have everything written down. So there's no excuse for any of us to say, well, I couldn't access all this information, because it is there. Now, how does this relate to Babylonia? Because the oral tradition was finally written down by two rabbis. Their names were Ravina and Ravashi. And they wrote it down in the form of the Babylonian Talmud. Now, you might say, but wait a minute, Rabbi, you said it's the oral transmission. But it's in a book. Why would that be? So it's a great question. So in the time of the Romans, they wrote a short, succinct version known as the Mishnah. And the Mishnah is sort of a framework for all of the oral Torah. Why was it written down? Because the Romans were doing such a lovely job at persecuting and killing and torturing our people that the rabbis really had a clear and present danger. Oh my gosh, they thought, if one generation passes and parts, components of that oral tradition, which were originally given to Moshe, to Moses and Mount Sinai, what if that chain is broken for one generation? How would you restore the lost knowledge? And of course the answer would be, you can't. So under the auspices of the great Rabbi Judah the Prince, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, he wrote down this sort of a bridge framework for all of oral tradition. And then later, that framework, which is called the Mishnah, anyone who remembers on Passover, we go, who knows one? I know one. One is Hashem. One is Hashem. Right? So you get to number six. Six are the books of the Mishnah. Right? So that Mishnah, those six Sidrei Mishnah, the books of the Mishnah, became the source for all of Talmud. So everything that we have that's called Talmud was a later fleshed out in entire arguments and presentation. Everything that we call today oral tradition is based in that Torah, Baal Peh, the Oral Torah, which is the Talmud, basically the Talmud from Babylonia, the Babylonian Talmud, which is that 2,700 plus folio of oral tradition, and that's based on the Mishnah. Now you know everything you ever wanted to know. Class is over. We can go home. No, I'm joking. Now let's get to Rabbi Akiva. Now, why is it germane? Because we're going to learn in the end that Rabbi Akiva, for all intents and purposes, wasn't just this amazingly brilliant man. He was heroic. He was visionary. And he is, I'm going to use a very powerful analogy, he is, for all intents and purposes, he is to the oral tradition what Moshe was to the written Torah. I'll say it again. We say Moshe kibel Torah miSinai. Moses received the Torah, and that's the holiday coming up very, very soon, 2 weeks or so from today, called Shavuot, where we recreate and imagine the revelation, the Decalogue, commandments, and the Torah given at Mount Sinai, that transcendent moment. That was Moses getting the written Torah. Now, while he was up Mount Sinai, he was up three different times for 40 days and for 40 nights. And he became almost like an ethereal creation. Didn't need to eat or sleep because he was in close proximity to God. During that time, he wasn't just given the Torah, the written Torah, what's called the Torah Shivchtav, but he was taught by God the framework of the oral tradition, which he transmitted to his great student, Joshua, to the elders, and it was passed generationally down. So when we speak of the oral Torah being written down, its source is Moshe. But the end source is Rabbi Akiva. In other words, Rabbi Akiva is credited with the framework for all of Mishnah Talmud, the Gemara. Everything you know in learning, it's all Rabbi Akiva. So I'm drawing the comparison that Moses was to the written law, the Bible, the five books of Moses. In other words, we're talking Genesis through Deuteronomy. That was Moses. Rabbi Akiva is all the oral master, if you will. Okay? So this Talmudic quote from Tractate Yevamot 62b, source 1, is going to teach us why we mourn during this 33-day period of time. This is really the main source and only source in all of the 2,700 pages, and there's not a lot here. So we're going to have to do a Rabbi Akiva and kind of mine the words for what's really going on. That's what the rabbis do. They'll look at a word, an oddity, and a spelling, or an extra letter. They'll say, what's going on here? So let's read this story, the tragic story of the deaths of Rabbi Akiva's students. Number one, Rabbi Akiva, and he is quoting now from Ecclesiastes. It says like this, even if one has learned Torah in his youth, or as they say in the movie, in his youth, even if one has learned Torah in his youth, he should learn Torah in his old age. Even if one had disciples, students, in his youth, he should have disciples in his old age. How do we know this? As it says, in the morning, sow your seed. Baboker, zeroe zarafa, it says. In the morning, sow your seed. Uba'erev, and in the evening of life, we're talking metaphorically, the morning would be the early part of a human being's life. The evening would be the twilight years, right? We even say that colloquially. At the evening, do not idle. Means don't stop growing in Torah. For you cannot know which will succeed. This, meaning the earlier part of your life, or that, the later part of your life, or whether both are equally good. Just stop for 1 second. So Rabbi Akiva, ironically, quotes the Torah, and he says that a person should look at life as a continuum of growth. And we don't say, oh, I'm going to go retire in Miami and put up my feet there on the beach. And that's good for a few weeks. That's okay. But we don't retire from life. And we know this even without Torah basis, right? Tragically, people who just don't have a reason to occupy themselves, unfortunately, the mind also feels like unoccupied. So it's important till 120 that we keep trying to seek out new realms of learning, education, just stimulation, correct? So Rabbi Akiva is now quoting, really, it's a great source, right? This is written a couple thousand years ago. Don't rest on your laurels. So let me ask you a question. Rabbi Akiva had 24,000 students. I don't know about you, but if I had 24,000 students who were all brilliant, off the charts, potential giants of Torah learning, I think I'd be pretty assured that I'm going to be okay and I could kind of like, my job is done here, ladies and gentlemen. I'll now go retire. Instead of living like in, you know, I think Rabbi Akiva spent most of his time in Yavne. So I'm going to go to the south of Israel, to Eilat, and I'm going to get one of those big fruity cocktails on the beach. And I'm going to just chill a little bit, as my son would say. You know, we're going to enjoy life. No. Because one doesn't know. If you keep working, both in the early, the morning of your life, and in the evening, twilight years of your life, and you keep producing students, you keep producing whatever you do in your life, one doesn't know what will ultimately be the defining point of one's life. It could be this or that, or it could be all of it equally. So in other words, we're saying that in the greatest scenario, a person could teach, could develop. If anyone here has ever taught students, you will know that sometimes the most difficult students, the ones that you thought you didn't connect with, are in fact the ones that surprise you, and later on, they'll come thank you. I remember, I'll never forget, I had a little boy in fourth grade, very difficult little boy, oh my gosh. And I'm pretty good, without being arrogant, at connecting to people. So I knew how to connect to my students. I never connected to this boy. I was flummoxed. I couldn't connect to this boy. And I did my best. Okay. I got a phone call 4 years later at the graduation of this boy from eighth grade to high school. A big thing they did in Memphis, Tennessee. The official graduation, you know? And this cantor, this dear friend of mine, calls me up and says, Rabbi Kaplan, I want you to know, so-and-so gave the valedictorian speech, and he only spoke about you. And I was like blown away, because I'm thinking to myself, what? I mean, if you had given me a bet, he never would have appeared in the top 100 likely, you know, people to ever, like, remember me even. But I guess, you know, you have an impact. Sometimes you're not even aware of that impact that you might have on another soul. So it's an amazing thing. So that's what we're saying right here. We don't know. How could we know? In the long term, right? Only Hashem sees the past, the present, and the future. We say, don't rest on your laurels, because one doesn't know one's impact on somebody else. And I'm sure each of you, if you think about it, you had relationships and impacts in different people in your own experiences, and they surprise you. They come back to you years later, and they say, oh my gosh, thank you for smiling at me that day in the hallway. And you're like, what are you talking about? Right? In other words, we all have that, where you're looking right here at a relationship or at a success, and God sometimes says, you know, you're looking in the wrong place. Just fix your gaze over here a little bit. That's the part that you're going to one day really shaknachas. You're going to get lots of pleasure from what you did for this person here. And it's an astounding, that's the magic and miracle of life. So Rabbi Akiva's saying, you just never know. Don't rest on your laurels. Now, this is tragically autobiographical. Remember, he made the quote. This is his quote. Rabbi Akiva had these glorious 24,000 students. And then we're going to learn, as you'll see in a moment, that was the boker, that was the morning, the early part of his projected learning and teaching. But then later in his twilight years, he succeeded with 5 students. So it's eerily autobiographical. Because if you had bet on the 24,000, you would have lost your bet. If you had bet on the 5 of his old age, that's the reality. So it's very autobiographically powerful. So let's read the rest of the quote. You ready? They said, meaning the rabbis, we're in the beginning of the fourth line. Rabbi Akiva had 12,000 pairs of disciples, of students. And they went from Givat to Antiparis, north and south of Israel. And they all died during one period, meaning one 33-day period of time. Why? Because they did not treat each other with respect. The world was left barren, meaning in terms of Torah teaching and learning, until Rabbi Akiva came to our rabbis in the south and taught Torah to them in his old age. Who were these rabbis of the south? Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Judah, Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Shimon, Rabbi Simon, and Rabbi Elazar ben Shemua. It was these later disciples who upheld the study of Torah at that time. A Tana stated, a rabbi of the Mishnah, all of the 12,000 pairs, 24,000 disciples, died between Pesach, Passover, and Shavuot, and this holiday coming up in 2 weeks. Specifically, this period of time. By Lag BaOmer, they stopped dying. That's why there's a celebration. Okay, so let's go back over this and unpackage it very quickly. You see there's not a lot here. What?
Why do they refer to as pairs?
Oh, excellent question. We're going to come to that in a minute. Do you hear his question? See, I asked everyone to pay attention because there's not a lot of information here. And Dr. Adelson just asked a brilliantly Talmudic question. If there's 24,000 students, why does it keep with the refrain of 12,000 pairs of students? Is that significant? It's incredibly significant. So thank you. We'll come back to that in a moment. Why do they die? The only thing we know is they did not treat each other with respect. What does this mean? So, okay, let's pretend we're in the house of learning, the yeshiva of Rabbi Akiva, okay? It's the morning session is about to start, the learning. So these guys are coming in to learn. And instead of saying, hey, good morning, and smiling at each other and saying, how are you? Batzerzach, shalom aleichem, good to see you. How's the family? They just sort of walked by with a scowl, the Darth Vader stare, and went on to learn. Seriously? We're supposed to believe this? It's impossible. So that cannot be what it means when it says they didn't respect each other, one for another. We have to understand what that means. And it's going to relate very much to the 12,000 disciples, the pairs. Okay? But before we do, I'm going to give you all, we do a lot of little background learning. So I made source 2 very large for my eyes too. Okay? So I hope you appreciate that I could have gotten the font larger, but then I would have had no ability to print it on one page. So I tried my best. This quote, and I could have chosen any part of the Torah, but I chose this because this is the Song of the Sea. You may recognize this. This is known as the Az Yashir Moshe, which is part of our morning prayers. Every single day we pray the Song of the Sea, the Shirat HaYam, the song after Yul Brenner and his boys went down in the water, and the Jewish people triumphantly marched through the dry land across to the other side. Moses and then Miriam, his sister, led the men and the women in song, the Song of the Sea. So I don't want to know about what the words mean, but I want to look at the letters. So for those of you who are not experts at Hebrew, I'll help you with this one. So let's start on line 2. Hebrew is read right to left for those who are not Hebrew experts. So that first word is oz, then. If you look at the second letter, Zion, you notice there's a little colorful little crown, a flourish above the Zion. Do you see that little flourish above that letter Zion that goes up? Then the next word, yoshir. The second letter, shin, at the left side of the shin, again, there's a little flourish. Okay? Third word. Now you understand why I chose this quote, because there every word has this. Moshe. Again, on the shin, second letter of Moses' name, you have that little flourish above the shin. Fourth word, uvene. Above the nun, the third letter, there's that little flourish above the nun. And then the fifth letter, Yisrael, the sin has that little flourish on the left side, right over here. The next word, et, does not have any flourish. Hashira, there's a flourish. What are those flourishes? So we call them taget, crowns. They're crowns. They're crowns. What's with the crown? Why did God put crowns on certain letters, but not on all the letters? I mean, they look beautiful. They're like a little artistic rendering to make the Torah more dynamic, I guess. If you're someone with an appreciative artistic bent, you would enjoy that. But is there more to it? It's a whole lot more. I will be very unsuccessful in actually trying to explain to you what I'm going to explain to you now. I'm going to explain to you sort of the broad strokes. I wish I was on the level. I wish any rabbi today could try to really understand what those flourishes are about. If they do, they're way above any rabbi living today's pay grade. Okay? Incredible. I am not going to read source 3, but it's there to take home tonight. I'm going to paraphrase what's going on. Source 3 is, again, Talmud, Babylonian Talmud. And here's what you have to know from the entire quote. Okay? when Moses went up Mount Sinai to get the Torah, it said, now this is all anthropomorphized, okay? So please, this is God as a human being, he's not a human being. So he goes up Mount Sinai, and God is about to give Moses the copy of the Torah, the Bible. But before he gives it to him, he says, no, Moses is not finished yet. And he's attaching, he's writing like a scribe. You can picture like, you know, this old man with a long beard, you know, and he has his quill, because that's what they use, the quill with ink. And he, instead of just giving the finished product of the Torah, of the Bible, to Moses, he's laboriously putting those little crowns on the special letters that require it. So it's taking a lot of extra time. So Moses looks at, probably, I mean, again, this is not, didn't really happen this way. It's very much of an imagery for our benefit as humans to understand. So you can imagine like Moses coming and looking over God's shoulder, you know, and he's looking at the letters and he sees a finished product. But God is going back and sort of the Zion of Oz has to have that little crown and then the Shin of Yashir. So Moses looks at it and he has a quizzical look on his face and he says to God, I don't understand. Why don't you just give the Torah as it is? We're ready. It looks like a finished product to my eyes. Why can't we just give it as is? Why are you taking time? Why are you preventing the giving of the Torah while you attach the crowns? In other words, what's the significance of the crowns? So God looks at Moses and says, it's okay, Moshe. Relax. It's not for you. But hundreds of years from now, there's going to be one man. His name is Rabbi Akiva. And he is going to look at the shapes of those crowns, and he is going to, from the shapes, this is the part that's way off the charts here, ladies and gentlemen, he is going to, from based on the shapes, learn heaps and heaps, a myriad of insights into the Torah and laws. Moses is absolutely blown away, and he says, please, God, I'm not going to live to see this Rabbi Akiva. Could you show me, because you're God, you can do anything. Can you show me, like, you know, what Rabbi Akiva is like? I would love to just meet him somehow or see him in action. Wow, that he could do this? And again, this is Moses talking to God, right? Like, it's beyond Moses somehow. Again, it's not sacrilegious. It just means, and I'll explain to you, that Moses didn't need to understand Torah the way Rabbi Akiva needed to understand Torah. Because Moses is getting the Torah from God. Rabbi Akiva didn't get the Torah from God. He had to sort of break his teeth and extrapolate and use different modes of exegesis and things to teach and learn Torah. So it's a different modality. Okay, so Moses says to God, please show me him. Talmud says, again, this is an amazing Talmud. It's mind-bending. He says, okay, come into the matrix. And so in Moses' mind, he enters the academy, the yeshiva of learning, when Rabbi Akiva is teaching. And Rabbi Akiva is there, and they show Moses to his seat, and they only gave him the eighth row. Apparently it's based on how knowledgeable you are of Rabbi Akiva's methods for learning, and Moses only made it to the eighth row. Lovely. Okay, so Moses sits down, and he's in the class, okay? He's in the shir. Rabbi Akiva's at, you imagine we're all, you have Rabbi Akiva at the front, and Moses is in the eighth row. He's there learning from Rabbi Akiva in his mind. And Rabbi Akiva gives a class. Moses doesn't understand anything of what's going on. It's like if I was projected into a, you know, to Stephen Hawking, you know, a class on physics or whatever, I would just, like, not a word. I wouldn't even understand anything that's going on, nor should I. So it's like Greek to him, even though the Greeks don't exist yet. So what happens? Actually, they did, but not in the time of Moses. So what happens? So Moses is he's upset because he thinks, wait a minute, I got the Torah from God, yeah? And yet this is the Torah that's being taught generations later. It's not the same Torah. So like, what's going on? Where do I fit in? So all of a sudden at the end of the class, one of Rabbi Akiva's students puts up his hand and says, Rebbe, teacher, rabbi, what's the source for this law? Rabbi Akiva looks at the student and says, it's a law given to Moses from God. That's why we accept it. It's our law. Ah, Moshe thinks to himself. He gets quoted, you see. He says, wow, they're still quoting me. So it obviously is sourced right here and now on Mount Sinai. Everything's okay. Just because I don't quite understand the modality of learning and what the crowns mean, etc., clearly it's necessary, and the source is still me. Meaning, not I'm important, but that it's from God. It's the same Torah. Now, just to give you a little background, okay, Moses didn't need to learn Torah the way Rabbi Akiva learned Torah, because Rabbi Akiva learned Torah that wasn't directly given to him. In other words, when Moses had a question from God about a law, you come to Moses, Rabbi, right? Rabbi, is this a good supervision? Do I have to wait a certain amount of hours to do this, to eat milk and meat or whatever, or something happened to her? You know, is this kosher, not kosher? So if Moses didn't know the law, he just picks up his Verizon God phone and he says, well, just hang on a moment. Hashem? Yeah. Have Mr. Cohen is here and he wants to know. Oh, it's okay? Fine. Mr. Cohen, God says it's good. That's pretty good, right? If you have a question, ask the rabbi, and you got God on speed dial. So Moses didn't need to be Rabbi Akiva. It's not like he couldn't have understood what Rabbi Akiva was teaching and learning. It wasn't part of the requirements. Moses got his Torah almost like organically from God. Okay. So then Moses comes back, and Moses has a question for God. He says, I have a question, he says. You have a man like Rabbi Akiva who can even understand the shapes of these little crowns. Why not use him as your messenger to give the Torah to the Jewish people? Why me? He's greater than I am, I guess, in some way. And you know what God says to Moses? Be quiet. I've ordained it this way. This is the way it is. So Moses is like, okay. In other words, don't ask any more questions. It's got to be you. It's not going to be Rabbi Akiva. Okay. Then Moses asks a question. Okay, you showed me his greatness of learning. Show me his reward. This is tough.
Terrible.
Really bad. So God says, okay, you want to see his reward? Join me again in the movie of the mind. And he shows the Romans, after the tortuous death, they flayed Rabbi Akiva's flesh off his body. They sold pounds of his flesh in the market. So they show this to Moses. Moses, again, he says, God, I don't understand. This is the Torah, and this is the reward for teaching and learning Torah, that you allow Rabbi Akiva to be tortured to death and flayed? What?
And sold.
And so, and then you know what God's response to Moses is? Do not ask questions. This is the way it is. Again, that'll be another class. Why do bad things happen to good people? But that's not today's class. Okay. Horrible. That's the end of the story of Rabbi Akiva and Moses. So what did we just find out? Amazing, right? Remember I equated Moses as the master of the written law, which he really is. We say this is the Torah Moshe. This is the Torah of Moses. That's a reference to the written law, the Bible. But the oral law, it really is Rabbi Akiva. And amazingly, in some weird way, according to the Talmud, Moses even sees Rabbi Akiva while he's up on Mount Sinai getting our Bible, getting our Torah. Right? It's amazing. Okay. Now let's get back to our question at hand. How come the students of Rabbi Akiva died? Why do we mourn them when we don't mourn for any other calamitous event individually, except as a collective mourning on the ninth of Av? Correct? That was our original question. And then Moshe Tzvi, Dr. Adelson, asked the question, how come it keeps referring to them as 12,000 pairs of students? Is that germane? It's very germane. So I'm going to mine that little Talmudic tractate section right at number one. Okay? So you don't have to look inside. It says they did not honor one to another. That's why they died. Remember I said to you, that doesn't make sense. The word honor in Hebrew is kaved. The fifth commandment says, kaved et avicha v'yetimecha. Thou shalt love your father, you shall honor your father and your mother. Okay? What does the word kavod mean? Doesn't mean honor. You know what it means? Heavy.
Pardon me?
Heavy.
Heavy?
Gravitas. Heaviness. The word kavod means heavy. So that means when you have respect and honor for somebody or something, they have weightiness to you. So that's interesting. That in Hebrew, in Lashon HaKodesh, in God's language, the word kavod comes from hebi. That person has respect, they command respect, an idea commands respect, because we even use that term. Remember, it became 20 years ago, there was someone in politics that used to say he has gravitas. Remember that word became like part of our language again. Gravitas, weightiness. Something that is weighty merits honor and respect. It is not talking about how they treated each other interpersonally. In other words, they didn't like disrespect each other when you know Joe says to Bill, "Good morning," and Bill just looks the other way and walks by. That's not what we're talking. They're not petty little boys. They're rabbi, young budding scholars. So what was the issue at hand? The issue at hand was they became hyper specialists in Torah knowledge and learning. And that's why the 12,000 pairs is so significant. Because they weren't 24,000 individual students who learned together. They were 12,000 two-man special teams. And what do? They each took maybe one little area of the crown, of the littlest minute sort of allusion to a law. And that became their area of specialty. And a subspecialty. So therefore, I'll give you an example. There was a publication years ago, some doctor in research in animal life was an expert on the eyelid of a crocodile. His whole research, for years, at a university level, was examining the eyelid of a crocodile. Somebody asked him, "What do you know about the rest of the crocodile?" He said, "Nothing." Now think about that. He knew the eyelid of the crocodile. Yes, I can write papers, peer-reviewed. But you'd ask me about the creature that the eyelid is part of? No. So that is literally missing the forest for the trees. In other words, it's one thing to become a specialist in an area of medicine. Hopefully you're still very conversant in the other areas of medicine. It's just that you dedicated yourself to a hyper-specialty, right? But to literally become a master of the eyelid of the crocodile, to the exclusion of the animal, you can get lost there and not even see there's a beautiful forest. So Rabbi Akiva was the master of those crowns that we showed in number two. So there were little allusions to things, and he was a master. But at the end of the day, Rabbi Akiva wasn't just a specialist. He was able to step back and integrate all of the disparate ideas that he mined through those crowns, and he put them together in a uniform presentation. So if you said to him, "Okay, Rabbi Akiva, we really got lost in the weeds. What does it all mean?" Rabbi Akiva would say, "I'm glad you asked. Here's what it means." And he would take this weed, and that weed, and that weed, and he would put them all together in a beautiful, coherent package. And he would say, "Now that we went into the data and we mined the weeds, now I'm going to show you the beautiful lagoon and what it all means to you." That was his unique capability. His students didn't have that. They got lost in the weeds. They got lost with the trees and the eyes of the crocodile. My rabbi, my one of my teacher, Rabbi Weinberg, told a real story. I know I've shared it with you once before, but I'll share it with you now. It's great. It's a tragic story, but it really happened. He was at a Jewish wedding. A man at the wedding was dancing very energetically, and he was felled by something. He just collapsed on the dance floor. "Is there a doctor in the house?" Baruch Hashem, you're at a Jewish wedding with 1,000 men and women. You believe me, there's doctors in the house. So everyone's running to his aid, right? And pushing his way metaphorically through the crowd is this older doctor who is a hyper-specialist in the gallbladder. He's a gallbladder expert, literally world-renowned. And he examines the man peripherally. He says he's having a gallbladder attack. There's a resident, young guy, who is looking and examining the man. He's looking over the shoulder of this hyper-specialist, world expert in gallbladders. And he dares not contradict this man, because this man, I guess, could like just squash him, and maybe his future would not exist in the world of medicine. But he turns to him, he says, "You know, have you ruled out a heart attack?" So the hyper-specialist looks at this young resident with indignation. "You're questioning me? Questioning me? How dare you?" The man died of a heart attack because they didn't treat him the way they would have treated a heart attack. So again, you could get lost in the weeds, in the little microscopic areas of those crowns, and not step back. In other words, what was the advantage? The only advantage that young resident had is that he didn't have a specialty. He was just learning. So it was a dover pashut. It was such an obvious thing. You got to rule out the big things when you see somebody. Number one, it's a heart attack or a stroke. Why are you jumping to the gallbladder? because that's the way he saw the world. In other words, the prism through which this hyperspecialist saw the entire world was through the prism of the gallbladder. Finished. End. But you see how dangerous that is. If you're limiting yourself to the eye of the crocodile or to the gallbladder, you miss out the human anatomy, the rest of the body, and what could be. Rabbi Akiva's students each had a specialty to the exclusion of the other 11,999 subspecialists. That was the issue of honor. In other words, we said weightiness. When you ask them, okay, let's pick Chaim and Maisha. Chaim and Maisha, what do you think about Reuven and Shimon's, their theories? They'd say, ah, that's garbage. Now ours, the two of them would say, ours is Torah. Theirs, not so much. That was the lack of respect. In other words, they did not ascribe weightiness, respect, honor, and truth to any of the other 11,999 pairs of students. And as Dr. Adelson asked, why is it significant that it's pairs and not just the numbers? Because when you have someone else in the game with you, you have someone else to validate your opinion, whether it be true or false. So the two had their own little echo chamber where they felt, oh, we're right. Them? Not so much. So again, what was the issue at hand? The issue at hand was that they had mined Rabbi Akiva's brilliance of the Torah, the little hyper-specialty where he could even look at the little design on the letters and somehow understand what that could mean. And they took the little designs of those letters and they got lost in the weeds and in the little letters. In the crowns of Torah, wiped them out. Now, the rabbis, in one opinion, say that you know how they died. They didn't die. The Gemara just says there was a disease, and it identifies the disease. More than likely, when the rabbis wrote down this whole scenario, they were worried about Roman persecution. The Romans killed them. They died. You know how they died? It's a historical event. The Betar massacre. Hundreds of thousands, or 100,000 or so Jews lost their lives. There was a man named Bar Kosiba, Bar Kochba. And Rabbi Akiva at one time believed that this man, Bar Kochba, Bar Kosiba, could be the Messiah, could be the Mashiach. And they rebelled against Rome. They lost. And when the Romans took revenge, they really took revenge. So it would be very logical to say that if Rabbi Akiva was Bar Kosiba, Bar Kochba's number one supporter, that the revenge was targeted towards those 24,000 who probably were with Bar Kochba in the rebellion. So yes, they died, but they were targeted by the Romans for their association with Rabbi Akiva. So that sort of gives us a little... So in other words, sometimes when the Torah wants to protect and not offend the ruling party, they will hide and cloak. So the disease that the Talmud refers to is actually a Roman disease, but they didn't want to come out and say it. So everyone could wink at each other and say, well, we know who we're referring to, but if the Roman censors would read it, and they knew how to read it, they won't get angry at us and persecute us further. Okay, so let's look at the bottom of the page now, shall we? Number four. In Pirkei Avot and Ethics of Our Fathers, it says, wow, he who exploits the crown of Torah shall fade away, shall die. That's exactly what the class was today. These 24,000 students at 12,000 pairs got immersed in what? Rabbi Akiva's crowns. The crowns of Torah. They exploited them for their own use. And it killed them. They didn't last. But we're not going to end on that sour note. Because if you recall, the very first quote of Rabbi Akiva, in the morning and in the evening, you keep learning and teaching and doing what you need to do. Because one doesn't know where the success will come from. Whether the Boker, the morning of one's life, the evening, the twilight years, or maybe both. So clearly what happened to the Boker, the morning of Rabbi Akiva's life? He lost them. He lost the 24,000. But the magnificence of Rabbi Akiva, he didn't give up. He was shattered, clearly. But he didn't give up. And he went to the south, as we were told in that Talmud, and he trained five new students. And those five new students are the reason we are sitting around the table now learning Torah. Because they are the students responsible for the framework of all of the oral tradition. How do we know this? The last quote. Rabbi Yochanan says, an unaccredited Mishnah, the six books of the oral Torah, was written by Rabbi Meir. And then it goes on to list other parts of the Torah. Rabbi Nechemiah, Rabbi Shimon. And all of these rabbis, and this is the whole framework of the oral tradition, the last line, are according to the teaching of Rabbi Akiva. So in other words, Rabbi Akiva triumphed. Yeah, he lost. But he got up from his mourning. He famously was walking with rabbis in the temple area. He was alive at the time of the destruction of that temple, of that second temple. And they saw movement within the holy Har HaBayit, that temple mount, where the Alaska and Dome of the Rock are today, where Jewish people, it's controversial whether we should pray there or not pray there. They saw movement there, and a fox ran from within there. And the rabbis with Rabbi Akiva, they started to cry. They just bawled their eyes out. They said that we should see animals playing in God's home. Rabbi Akiva turned to them and said, but the prophet said there will come a day where the foxes will be here. The temple will be laid to waste. So they looked at him with tears in their eyes. And then Rabbi Akiva said, but God also said in that prophecy, one day the temple will come back. The third temple will be rebuilt, will be restored. And if now we see that the first prophecy has been realized today, then the promise of that second prophecy will be realized. So we haven't had that realization yet. But we all are like Rabbi Akiva. We all have the vision. We've all been knocked down. We've all suffered darkness. Our world has suffered darkness. But we have to remember, the foxes might be playing in the temple, but the promise of God to redeem us in the end, that's Rabbi Akiva's vision. That's why, listen to this, and I'll leave you with this. When you go to Israel one day, you'll go to Tiberias, and you'll see a monument. The students took the bones that were left after Rabbi Akiva's torture, and they hid them up in a cave on the side in Tiberias, on a mountain. And they built a monument there. As Rabbi Akiva was being tortured to death, they were looking out over the water. And the Roman inquisitors who were torturing him decided to give him a shtuch, you know, just a last parting insult. And they showed boats leaving the harbor with captive Jews. And they said, Rabbi Akiva, that's your future there. The Jews have left Israel. They're done. When the Jews first came back 2,000 years later, they came to Tiberias, and the first returners, the Olim who left to come back to Israel, went to Tiberias. They paid and hand-constructed that monument over Rabbi Akiva's grave to testify to Rabbi Akiva that Roman was full of hot air. We're back, and God has kept his word. We will all be redeemed. He will keep his word. Thank you, everyone.